You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything. Feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are. And if it's all your fault. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all. So why don't you?
9:15 on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving here on All Marine Radio. Joining me from the state of Texas is Tim Lynch. Timmy, good morning. How are you? Happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, happy Thanksgiving to you, Matt. Glad to be here. Thanks.
There you go. And from Southern California, just out from running errands, is Jeff Kenny. Jeff, happy Thanksgiving. Good morning.
Good morning. Errands have just begun. Happy Thanksgiving to you and Tim. I'm in a frenzy of task accomplishment.
Really? Well, congratulations.
Yeah, it's fun.
Okay, first things first. What are you most thankful for this year, Timmy? Earth to Lynch. Hello? Oh, he muted.
Hey, I'm sorry, buddy. I've got a bunch. I've got the lawn guys are out here, you know, and normally in this part of the country, when all these people show up with lawnmowers and weed whackers, that's not a good sign. But I know these guys. I just had it muted to try to find that out.
Well, I can't hear anything.
Oh, good. Awesome. I guess this microphone works. But what I was saying was, I was most thankful for, I've had a good year. I'm most thankful to have a wife and a great relationship. And my kids are doing well. My parents are doing well. My siblings are doing well. Everything is good with the Lynch family.
Wow, listen to that. Yeah. That's kind of a scary report, actually. All right. Jeff, how about you? Moving to Vegas?
I have to say, I, too, will parrot what Tim said about my case, but it's more because I have to say it, otherwise I'll get in trouble. I'm thankful, every Thanksgiving lately, I've been thanking God that I had a chance to be a jarhead and actually be in combat for my country. And, you know, that is such a privilege. It's rarer than you think, you know. So I'm just thankful for having that chance and having that in my life, actually most of my life. So
why, I mean, do you think it's the way we grew up in the shadow of World War II Korea and in the midst of Vietnam that, you know, that culture surrounded us, and so there was a desire on most of our friends' part to not only serve but to fight the way the people that we grew up around talked about and have that experience?
Yes. I mean, it was, and even besides the Marine Corps, when I was a young kid, like in the 60s, I remember playing football, and the worst thing you could have happen was if you're on the line, was to have the guy make a first down over your hole, you know, if you're a tackler or guard, or, you know, to be the guy who didn't do his job or wasn't successful at his job. And it was drilled into you that you're worthless, or, you know, it was very Spartan-like, isn't it? If you can't do your job and you can't accomplish the mission, then someone else has to make up for you. You suck. And conversely, if you are the type of guy who does a job, you know, and the philosophy that helps you get through that is the philosophy of whenever you get a chance to help a buddy, even though sometimes you don't feel like it, you do it because someday you might need that. Otherwise, you'll be in the hell of being the guy who's looked at in askance because he didn't come up to snuff, you know?
Interesting. Timmy, your dad was, you know, he's general, well, he wasn't a general officer when you were a kid, but you grew up in that environment. That in a certain way shape your world relative to service and not only service but the desire to go fight.
Oh, without a question. I mean, when in 2003 when I was out and no route back in because of medical issues, I couldn't come back in. That's why I started being a contractor, and I'm thankful I had that opportunity, particularly because I saw all of you overseas in Afghanistan, and I've treasured your memories. So I'm like Jeff. I'm sitting here listening to Jeff, and you know, if you had like a searchable way of going through all your podcasts and stringing together Jeff Kenney quotes for anybody that was like down and needed some motivation and whatnot. Talk about cutting right to the quick. Brother, I love those stories. Just love them.
No, I like the one about getting kicked in the balls by his gunny better. Like all the motivational shits, all right. But that story's the best, man, honestly.
Well, also, it's Thanksgiving, and he's thankful he got in combat a bunch of times. I love that shit.
Right. Well, you know what? I mean, truthfully, I mean, how do you articulate what you see, the selflessness and the courage? And for Marines, you don't see it once in a while. I mean, you see it every day. And I don't know if you guys know this, but Rolling Stone magazine put me in their 2006 end of the year edition.
Wow.
Yeah, a quote from me. Wow. I'm doing my radio show in 2007, I think it was 2007. No, it was 2006. I got back from Fallujah at the end of the year. So I'm doing my radio show, and somebody calls in and says, "Hey, Mac, do you know you're in Rolling Stone?" And I said, like, what do you mean? Like, what Rolling Stone? And they're like, yo, stupid, there is only one Rolling Stone. I'm like, the magazine? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, well, what do you mean? Am I in the background of a picture or something? Like, I found Jeff Kenney of? And so I'm looking for a picture of Secretary Spencer to put up on, right, in one of the podcasts. And so I see him in a controversial picture because he rolled through Afghanistan with a sidearm. And everybody's like, oh, that's like, why would he do that? There's nothing dangerous that goes on here. Yeah, that's ridiculous. Like, oh, Spencer, he's a former Marine. He's like out of his mind. Like, dude, the most terrifying thing, right, is when you're slick. You don't have anything, right? You're naked. Like, oh, God forbid. So anyway, there's a picture. So I'm looking at this picture, right, and I'm kind of getting ready to put it as part of the post. And I look in the background. Right, and stand there in a pair of black pants with his arms folded across his chest with this frown on his face. I look, I'm like, that's Kenny. What the fuck?
I know, I'm like Zelig, man. I'm everywhere.
He is. He's standing there like passing judgment on the SecNav as he's speaking like, I could do a better job than that. So I said, well, what do you mean? And like, you're quoted in Rolling Stone magazine. And I said, like, are you shitting me? And they're like, no, I'll send it to you. And so they sent it to me. And hold on, give me 1 second to grab it, because it's here in my vast library. 1 second. Okay, so it is the Rolling Stone special double issue yearbook 2006. So I get this thing, and there's all the Rolling Stone covers on it, and then 50 best albums, 100 greatest songs, the year in music, blah, 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 fucking blah. And so I'm looking through, and they have this quote. And so, I'll tie this all together in that I had got elected. I didn't know I couldn't run for office while I was on active duty. That's like against the UCMJ. And so I went in and I talked to, to Larry Nicholson. And I said, hey, the dude in my hometown who's my city councilman isn't going to run. Do you care if I put my name in the hat for that? He goes, no, I think that's awesome, man. And I said, okay. And so I put my name on the ballot, and I won. And so I couldn't really like do very many interviews. I couldn't really do very many interviews because I was like, I worked at night, and then we were doing all this soft shit at night, trying to kill Zarqawi. And so they'd like email me, hey, could you be interviewed? And I'd be like, I really can't be. So finally, I got interviewed by the Associated Press. And so it says, can I get back to you about that pothole? Okay. And I want to say this is called Troubling Times. The section is called Troubling Times. And it says, Grand Forks, North Dakota, a local candidate was elected to city council even though he conducted his entire campaign from Iraq. Mike McNamara, who was serving his second tour of duty in the war, beat out four other candidates. How about that for a fucking beatdown, okay? Right? Without setting foot in the state, he participated in his first council meeting via speakerphone. Quote, when you come here and see the terrible ways young men get killed, McNamara said, it consecrates democracy for you. Now, I read that, right? And so why would Rolling Stone put that in there? Because they believed it? Probably not, right? So they're making fun of me. But, I mean, that's what you, I believe, I mean, I'm being Catholic, consecrates is a very pregnant term, right?
Yeah.
When you see shit go wrong and you see Marines, they don't come and say, hey, what's the best way to come? You know, they'll come and they'll die. And you see that every day. And so to me, when they would ask me, well, why would you run for office? I mean, you're already doing blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, look, I'm a reservist. When you go home, you go through withdrawal, like Timmy's talking about. Like, that's where I want to be. I mean, that's the most significant, you know, other than my kids and my wife at the time, other than those commitments in my life, this is the most, you know, significant thing I've ever done. And I've dreamt about this. I've read about this since I was a little kid. And so all I'm trying to do is continue that service. And, I mean, people at first they thought I was joking, right?
Right.
Oh, what are you, fucking Jack Armstrong? Like, well, no, that's true. If you could see the blood sacrifice that gets made here on a daily basis, it truly does consecrate democracy. And that's why when you look at the shit that goes on in Washington, D.C., it so deeply fucking offends you. So, anyway, but I think we all were like, we all grew up in that period. We all grew up reading, watching I did an interview with Mike Marletto, and he talked about watching Rat Patrol, watching Combat, watching 12 O'Clock High, you know, watching Victory at Sea, you know, when it finally came on, right? All those things, and then going to school and being taught and coached by veterans and how much they shaped us.
You know what I caught from that Marletto interview early on that was interesting?
What?
And how many guys have you come on, that have come on your show that have done very, very well, came into the Marine Corps because of a cold call or a chance contact during an area canvassing event?
Dude, it is like Woody Williams. Hey, I saw a guy in a dress blue uniform. That thing looked really sharp. I knew I could get a girl. Like, are you shitting me? And then he winds up on Iwo Jima. Right, and is awarded the Medal of Honor.
No, hey, I'm telling you again, man, Paul Kennedy, you should be listening to this. The recruiting command ought to be gathering those snippets up, because I want to tell you something. Recruiting's tough, and making cold calls is very, very difficult, as is area canvassing. But my God, you keep on hearing over and over again from the guys that you interviewed, and they may mention it offhand. Oh, I got a phone call from a recruiter. And I'm listening to that. I could have used that kind of information when Jeff and I were on recruiting. Holy smokes, man. It's a repository of shit.
I had been a recruiter, and I hated that more than anything, this calling from a list. So I got a guy. I had poolies. I remember I inherited a couple from the guy who got relieved before me. And but this was a staff sergeant.
Well, hold on. Listen to this. So this is when you were in Pittsburgh? Or where did you do your enlisted?
Pueblo. I was a canvassing recruiter as a staff sergeant.
Okay, just so everybody knows, Jeff went to RS Pittsburgh. Where how many RSCOs before you had been relieved?
Five. First guy, negligence, and the other four for non-production.
There you go, Jeff. Yeah. Jeff Kenny. Good luck. Good luck, there, Skipper.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. It's one of the treasured memories of my life. But at the time, I mean, it was I was pissed off. I felt like I had been. Like, I had done real good in the Marine Corps at that point. I got that trophy and everything. You know, I had been in combat and got decorated for that, you know, with my handling my company in Liberia. And then, as a reward, they give me this place where I had very little chance for survival. As a matter of fact, the guy who's the CO told me that, you know, the first time I talked to him.
Oh, really?
a staff sergeant, I couldn't, my ego couldn't stand that cold call because they tell you go fuck yourself and shit.
Right.
And so I get a guy, and I say, hey, you got a girlfriend? You know, I was thinking, what would motivate me, you know, to come in and see a recruiter? Sex, broads, you know? So I got a kid who had a pretty hot sex.
I don't know what just happened, but a B-52 just, it sounds like a B-17 just flew through.
It could be the NSA just muting out this part here, which is probably very entertaining.
Would you come in? I mean, the recruiter, they're looking at all the, like, the hot, or all the good guys from, you know, the senior class. And, all right, I'll come in. Are you going to be there? I'll probably be, I hang around, you know, Jimmy, her boyfriend, Jimmy Lopez. Not Jimmy Lopez. There was almost all these kids were Hispanic. And these kids come marching in, and I talk to them. And then I'm at an advantage because I'm no longer the begging fuckstick, you know what I mean? I'm the guy that they're in my office, and there's cool shit in there, you know? We had these old films from Vietnam, you know, like old, like you plug them into like a little mini TV, recruiting stuff. A lot of them are older, and that they had like old drill instructors and shit, because that's always been a gut-level fear for people joining the Marine Corps, what's going to happen to me at Paris Island or San Diego.
Well, and remember, though, this is before YouTube and all the shit was on the internet. Now, you didn't see this shit.
Right. So, you know, that was one of the things that, you know, I'd figure out a way to, you know, and I'd be calling these things, right? And a phone would be ringing, like, well, three ringy dingies, four ringy, us. At five, you're allowed to hang up. I'm like, I hope nobody answers. And, because you knew you were going to, you know, it was rough. And I felt for my recruiters doing that. You try and sweeten the list, doing that, you know?
Well, that's what Marletto says. I'll tell you the other thing that's absolutely amazing in that interview, if you haven't listened to it, is, you know, he was in Beirut, and he spends one night out of that barracks, that headquarters barracks that got destroyed, and that is the night of October 22nd, or else, you know, but for the grace of God, Mike Marletto's name is on that list of Marines killed in action. And he said that. I didn't know that. I was like, holy shit.
That commander for the Mao?
What, say it again?
No, he was an artillery guy. He augmented out at SIL, Jeff. He was hit fire direction radar.
Yeah, he was out over there with the fire direction radars. And you know, he's working with some guys, and it was like, hey, like, why don't you have me out there? And then, you know, I can have a beer because I know you guys got it out there. And so he went out there, and then they couldn't get him back that night, and then the thing gets blown up in the morning.
Yeah, my company commander in the basic school was Brad Gates, who was the battery commander for BLT 28. The guys who relieved, the guys who got blown up.
Right.
These are E4 and all those guys. And he was a great, you know, for a lieutenant, you know, great guy about that. They talked about that, actually shooting live. So they didn't fire any arty rounds in Grenada, but they sure as shit did in Beirut, counter battery.
Hey. You know what I never knew? I never knew who. I knew there were soldiers killed in the BLT headquarters. I never knew why they were there. That was interesting.
Yeah. No, Mike. I didn't know Mike Marletto, but his wife had developed cancer, and then he didn't go back with the division to Iraq in 2004, and so I heard about him. And you know how you hear about guys that you've never met, but everybody who talks about him says, yeah, that guy he's the shit, man. He's great. And that's what I'd heard about Mike Marletto. And so, and then one day he sent me an email a couple years ago saying that he listened to All Marine Radio, and then I've got to know him. And then, but yesterday was the first time he ever appeared. And, looking forward to him coming back on, but.
Yeah, he was General Sattler's chief.
Right.
At the
mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that was an interesting interview, man. I enjoyed that immensely.
Well, and then his thoughts on fire support, you know, what it is and what we ought to be careful with. And so it's interesting. But, here's a, let me read you an email. Interesting what you all are grateful for. Not exactly what one would expect. Yeah. Well, I would tell you what I'm grateful for is, you know, since I've been doing post-traumatic winning for a year, and it's the way it's changed my life has been absolutely amazing. And that does not happen. And I went up and I said this in my speech in Las Vegas a week ago. You know, I said, you know, I think I'm here because I've done something good and I'm on the verge of doing something great. And that's why I'm here. And I'm going to tell you this. You can only do great things if you pursue your passions. So this is my advice to you. If you're passionate about being a Marine, it should show in the way you come to work and the way you do business every day. If you're here for 4 years, suck up everything the Marine Corps can teach you about being successful, about being a winner, and then go find what you love. If you want to be a guide and outfitter in Minnesota, right, but you don't have any of the qualifications, go get a job to support your family and go to work at Cabela's on the weekend. And then meet people and network into that. And I promise you, you won't work a day in your life. You know? But the greatness comes at a price in terms of time and effort. But if it's what you love, like our pursuit of leadership and decision making and, you know, Jeff and advising and all the different things we all have been, you know, Timmy's development of the Room of Pain and the physical aspect of decision making and leadership under duress. I mean, all that has come from our passions and it's all made great contributions to the Marine Corps. And so that was my message. But everything that I've learned, none of it is my own original thought. You know, all of it are things that have been taught to me by people that are connected with this culture of the Marine Corps. And not the Marine Corps institutionally, because Marine Corps institutionally struggles. But the culture of the Marine Corps that represents the Marines themselves is what, to me, it is magical and magic and what I've always been kind of, I've always been fascinated by. This kind of chip on your shoulder, fuck you, we'll do it anyway. Attitude that comes with Marines, and to include even this, dealing with, you know, life with trauma and what they've learned and the wisdom of all of it. I now look back and I think and just, you know, the Las Vegas Fire Department just signed on and said, yeah, you know, you're gonna, you know, come up and train our entire department. And so,
wow.
And so now other doors are opening. And again, this is all done on the down low, as you guys know. And,
yeah.
And so when ultimately, you know, the year closes out and statistics get made and things like that, and they get footnoted, I think there's going to be even more opportunity. So I mean, but again, it all comes from the culture, I think, that fascinated all of us, and that is this culture of fuck you, right?
Yeah.
And right, that's so funny in this high school way, right? This very blunt high school kind of stupid way. That's very cool. Very cool. Let me switch gears. I'm going to tee up some stuff from General Berger's speech after I ask you about thoughts on Secretary Spencer being fired. Timmy?
There's a fundamental foundational issue behind all this. First off, everything that I've heard, particularly with you and Andy Milburn's discussion, completely agree. What's going on here is bullshit. But there's a foundational issue that, because I mentioned Attorney General Barr's speech on the last show, and if you'll indulge me, let me just read a couple of sentences from that speech. And he's talking about the 2008 Supreme Court decision in Bodine v. Bush, in which, and I'm starting to quote, the Supreme Court overturned hundreds of years of American and earlier British law and practice, which had always considered decisions as to whether to detain foreign combatants to be a purely military judgments, which civilian judges had no power to review. For the first time, the court ruled that foreign persons who have no connection with the United States other than being confronted by military forces on the battlefield had due process rights of habeas corpus. And he goes on, and I'm going to jump up here, and he goes, for the first time in American history, our armed forces are incapable of taking prisoners. We are now in a crazy position that if we identify a terrorist enemy on the battlefield, such as an ISIS leader, we can kill them with a drone strike or any weapon, summarily. But if we capture them, the military is tied down in developing evidence for an adversarial process and must spend massive resources in terminal litigation as to whether there was sufficient basis to capture this prisoner. I submit to you that that's a bigger damn issue than just the travesty of what we've been with.
All right, well, okay, so quit trying to change the subject. Do you have any other comment about Spencer resigning?
No, I think he did the right thing. I wish that everybody had been this passionate about the decision by the Secretary of Navy to force women into the infantry after our recommendations against it. I think that was a bigger issue. But everything you've been saying is spot on. The what's going on right now is nonsense.
We could talk about that. Let me just tell you, because to me, there's elements of, you know, something that we've talked about before, and that is elements of moral courage. And everybody says in their confirmation hearings, so I will not hesitate, Senator, to speak truth to power. Oh, really? How about when it costs you your fucking job? Still willing to do it? And the answer too often among our flag and general officers is, no, sorry. Nothing to see here, boys. Just keep moving. Not going to get, and in the case of women in combat, there's all kinds of general officers who didn't believe that was the right thing to do. None of them said a fucking word.
Yep.
None of them said a fucking word.
You can't justify the unjustifiable. Anybody that knows, you can't justify it. And I don't care about meek and standard. Because what you're basically saying is women are the same as men.
No, I don't. But again, quit changing the subject. The issue is moral courage. And I don't care if it's expansion of the ground war in Afghanistan. You know, no phase four for Tommy Franks in either Iraq or in Afghanistan. We keep doing this shit. And these people that will then turn around and lecture people about pissing on bodies, because Marines have done that. Read with the old breed, okay?
Yeah.
Read the shit that's gone on in combat forever. And then all of a sudden we're aghast. Okay, I got it. It got on the internet and it was horrible, blah, blah, blah. But don't lecture Lance Corporals, right? Don't lecture lieutenants and then turn around and not do the fucking thing that you're requiring them of, which is to behave with the moral courage that you just lectured the whole fucking Marine Corps about. So to me, the moral courage piece is huge, and it's a huge problem in the DOD. Jeff, your thoughts on Spencer?
Well, when I saw, you know, the whole backdooring thing with the White House and trying to make it look like, trying to save their, like, you know, him trying to basically save, you know, serve two masters, the Navy officers who wanted this guy's scalp. And when they couldn't get it, they just wanted to hurt him as bad as they could. And then at the same time, doing right, you know, by his boss, the president, but trying to, you know, have it two, you know, both ways is how I kind of read what he was doing. I was disgusted. And when I met the guy in that picture that you mentioned, you know, a couple minutes ago, he seemed good, you know. He was a former Marine guy. I think he was an air winger. He was a pilot. Looked like he was getting along great. General Neller had a nice little conversation for about 5 minutes. And, you know, so I got nothing against that, against him, but I have to tell you, the vitriol that, these guys go after and how they'll line up and defy command authority over something like punishment of an enlisted guy, you know, especially an enlisted guy who did, you know, in their mind, questionable things in combat. They, like you guys have said, we know that they don't think it's smart, most of them, to have women in combat. We know that they think it's bizarre to be putting in these people who, you know, who can't decide whether they're men or women and put them in the service and act like they're normal. They're just, they know all that stuff and they know a lot of other things too. And, but they let all that shit, they shine all that stuff on. But this thing, I mean, married dudes in the Marine Corps living in housing next to you. I mean, come on. They shine all that on. Well, you know, that's just the way it is now. But let this happen, and they're ready to stand in the door for that. I mean, there's something wrong with them. I think it's like they're worried about their own power base. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter whether we win or lose. It only matters that we go on, that we continue on. You know, the service continues on, and our promotion, and, you know, and our benefits, and, you know, that keep coming up. And we're not going to let these little crass civilians who come in and they're in for 4 or 5 or 8 years, you know, ruin our chance to be a success, air quotes. You know, that's how I read this, and it pisses me off.
Yeah, I think I disagree with you about the Gallagher thing, though. I think that, you know, I think there's, if you believe what Esper said, so Esper goes to the White House and said, you've got to allow them to allow this to go forward. That's what, if they believe as a service chief or as the head of Naval Special Warfare, that this is the right thing to do, you've got, and you can set it aside in due time, right, when you get your whack at it, but you've got to allow them to at least lead their branch that they've been appointed to lead. And then evidence. So then, I mean, it's, to me, it's like the White House guys on the phone with Spencer. Hey, you know, the president's not happy, blah, 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 blah. And then Esper all of a sudden says, oh, you talked to the White House and you told them something. I think that's all bullshit. I think the bottom line is that Spencer knew when he said with his staff that we're going to allow this to go forward, he knew he was stepping on Cat One. He knew that taking on the president or not coming down on the president's side on this was going to be, you know, a reason for him to be fired. And so to me, there was no doubt what he knew he was setting up. And the pretense for it to me is it's like, okay, whatever. The bottom line was he took on the president in public and wasn't following the party line. I think though that there is a genuine good order and discipline issue. And we've seen, you know, whether it be murder or all the different things we've seen, that, you know, there's organizations that are struggling with this. And I don't know that this helps if at the end of the day, you know, Gallagher wins on all fronts. Who loses? The guys, the young SEALs that went and said, hey, this guy was shooting at civilians, and we were fucking with his rifle and shooting warning shots so he wouldn't murder people. Those guys lost.
Yeah, but there's other guys running that team who refute that. You know what I mean?
I disagree. You know, Jeff and I do not see this thing the same way. So anyway,
and it's like, there's such a thing as the First Amendment. But I have to tell you, if I was to, I really think a lot of the things we've been taking for granted our whole careers are no longer applicable. Like that Geneva Convention thing. It's ridiculous. It's stupid. I mean, there's no way that anybody we ever fight obeys that thing. So why the fuck are we? It's supposed to be an agreement that, you know, that both sides, you know, adhere to. But nobody adheres to it when it comes to us. You can't count how many enlisted Army and Marine POWs were taken by the Vietnamese. They just murdered them. And they murdered them because they didn't have the logistical heft to be able to handle them. The only prisoners they kept were ones who they could make some political hay out of. And it's the exact same thing with every enemy we've fought since Korea. I mean, even during the Second World War, the Japanese did not obey the Geneva Convention when it came to POWs or fighting the war. And so I think we should put out, we're not doing this anymore. And then what it does is this. You can still be a sweetheart if you want to all these people who surrender and shit. But at least out there then, you put it out and you said, look, don't count on being treated like, you know, an honored guest when you become a prisoner of the United States. Because, you know, we got people who are dying looking for people who are, you know, who are POWs who aren't really POWs. Like this thing with this that guy who went over the hill in eastern Afghanistan. You know, it's like there's things that we need to change. We need to change the way of looking at it. But I tell you, if you're going to bring women and, you know, these other, you know, strange people in the service and say they're good to go, they'll never get to that. Winning is considered, not only is it a foregone conclusion, it's really not necessary. Because people up there who are running things, the Republicans, Democrats, they can make hay one side or the other. And that's really what they're interested in. They're interested in what happens in America, not what America does. And that's a huge danger because they're in their mind, they take it for granted that we're always going to continue on.
I don't even know that they think about that. I mean, their radar doesn't extend beyond the next election. And let me tell you, and if anybody thinks Donald Trump gives a shit about the SEALs or Gallagher, then you don't pay attention. Donald Trump, right, does what's in Donald Trump's best interest. And if he thinks that he can, you know, he can make points. I mean, just like the fucking dog was at the White House the other day. You know,
yeah.
Why was the dog at the White House the other day? Because out of that whole fucking killing of Baghdadi, what was the, everybody will remember, we talked about it, what, a week ago or 2 weeks ago, like, oh yeah, that's the one with the dog. Oh yeah, the dog won. Yeah, that one. All those fucking guys risking their ass, right? And what's going to come out of that is, oh yeah, the dog. Yeah, he went to the White House. Oh yeah, that dog. That one. Yeah, so. But that's.
President, the one who's got the least out of it is President Trump. This guy gets pummeled. I've never seen this in my whole life. I'm talking from Nixon and all these people who are, you know, who the media.
Nixon got pummeled pretty good.
This guy gets hammered every day. He's tough. He puts up with it.
No, not in does he put up with it. He's redefined the presidency. Will the next president allow some schmuck to hold press conferences when he could go out for an hour every day and dominate the news cycle?
Yeah.
He just outcycles him, right? He just pounds it and pounds it and pounds it. So whatever he says, it becomes the news. Here's the president, right? You know, and he doesn't slow down. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't accept it. And then he gives it back to him twice as much. And the news cycle has a meltdown. He dominates it all the time.
I mean, I do a joke to my, I look and I think, you know, I watch the news and I think, most of these news people who are reading the news and then, you know, interviewing, and because it's a 24-hour news cycle, the news is there. This happened. Okay? Let's move on. But because it's 24 hours, they got to bring in a bunch of panels and do conjecture about what this means and what does it not mean, and it not meaning something, what does that not mean? It's ridiculous. You know, it's like, one thing they all seem to coalesce on, I think every network, including like Fox and everything else, there's a huge number of them, they see this guy as an existential threat to the bullshit artistry that they live by. And I'm not just talking about news media either. Entertainment, news media, they've been telling everybody in the United States that you're supposed to think certain ways. And here's a guy saying, why? And a lot of times he might be wrong that people were right to think a certain way, but he questions it. Especially when it comes to life or limb.
Well, I think one of the things that the news media has found so disturbing, and I want to say the nation has found so disturbing, is that, you know, and it'll be really interesting what the IG report from the DOJ says, what the investigation that the Attorney General is doing into the whole Russian corruption, you know, dossier. And what I hope they lay out is, it starts here. This money comes from this person. This person's linked to this person. And this is the pattern. This person here is now involved in the FISA warrant here. You know what I mean? And I hope they can lay that out for it, because, you know, in the American public, you know, nobody wants to believe that there is this thing called the deep state, right?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to believe that there's people that have sworn an oath to the nation that are going to put their hand, because they believe they know better, especially guys, you know, we've talked about James Comey, who I think is a clown, is you know, crank up the calliope music, right, and run his ass in, because he had a moral obligation when the president told everybody to get out of his office, right, and then Jared says, you want me to stay? He says, no, and the door closes. Comey had been told for months, right, he's going to lean on you, right? And you have to be really – well, there's one way. You look at the president and you say, Mr. President, I cannot have this discussion with you.
Yeah.
Right? I have to leave. And you leave and you go report it to the attorney general. That's not what that fucking coward did. He went, he made his notes, and he made his plan. And that's bullshit. And so I don't want to believe that. When those stories first came out, it's like, no way. That's an easy one for the director of the FBI. Come on. And then more and more of this shit came out, right? You were like, fuck, man, did it really go like that? Do we really have people in the FBI that are skewing it like that? And you found out the answer to that is, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's
the FBI history of that. I mean, it used to be just so they wouldn't look bad with the fuck ups they made when it came to arresting the wrong people and shooting people and shit like that. But it's bled over now into where they're useful, you know, they're useful when the government is after its own people, parts of their own people. And that's where they're at right now. I mean, I think it's amazing it took this long. I mean, it took like 100 years to even get something like the FBI in America. Yeah. You know, I mean, that didn't come up, and they didn't start using firearms until the mid-30s. But holy shit, since then, they've been involved in everything, and usually to our detriment. They're supposed to be a counterintelligence arm. They fucking missed Pearl Harbor. They missed the Russians stealing fucking secrets for the A-bomb. Then they missed the fucking Korean War, them and the State Department. You know, it's like pretty obvious. And they missed the fucking H-bomb. They did another, that's not good enough. We missed the fucking A-bomb. Now we're going to miss the H-bomb. They miss.
So this is not going to surprise anybody, but Jeff's not the biggest fan of the FBI.
Yeah. And I wish I used to be, but I'm looking, I'm like, you know, when you're, it's like Englishmen in the Helmand Province. When you're wrong so many times in a row, how can you be so sure you're right the next time? It's like them in the State Department. I'm like, you know, if I was as wrong as like these people, I would like be like, you know, not be, you know, ready to lean in on dumb ideas. Oh no, nope, they do.
Timmy,
hello?
Timmy,
yeah.
Thoughts? Doc Lynch?
Oh, Doc was on mute again. I wanted to go back to where Jeff had started because, you know, of our propensity to fight these limited wars against adversaries whose aims are not unlimited and whose willingness to sustain duration and great costs does not even come close to matching our political leaders' will to sustain those efforts. But that was so far in the past. God damn it, Jeff just said something that I lost the thought. But at any rate, that was entertaining, fellas.
let me.
I lost the thought.
That's it'll come when it comes to you. Scream.
Yeah.
Let me read to you some notes from the Commandant's speech at the Ground Board dinner, or whatever that dinner is, the Ground Board dinner. One, the presumption of sea power dominance is a thing of the past. Two, we have to regenerate a capability that deters aggression. Three, the premise of all of this is sea denial in close and in limited naval terrain. That is the role and mission of the United States Marine Corps. Conclusions, right? The rise of peer competitors, not near peer, the word chosen deliberately, is important to embrace as a premise. Minor changes in the Marine Corps will not suffice. It will only put us further back, right, as we go forward. And having to fight in new ways is a requirement for the Marine Corps. And then he went on to say, you know, this is not the first time we faced a crossroads like this. Amphibious warfare, right, the use of air support are all things that the Marine Corps has looked over the horizon at. So challenges, A, adapt, right? And that's what the force design that he's coming up with in the latter stages of the fourth quarter, to quote him, is looking at. B, and to not only bend the curve with force design, change the curve that will make other nations, right, stand up and look, and it so that it can become a deterrent capability. Six, prepare to operate within, right, contested areas, not into, but within. And I assume that means already being there. Interesting. The hallmark of these forces are going to be low signature, bad attitude, and disruptive capabilities. And then the next question is, what do we put into the Marine Corps Reserve stuff that can augment that force? So, I'm curious. You guys have watched this discussion for months now as it's gone on. Timmy, thoughts about any of that?
What's the role for the GCE in his vision? I'm not seeing any specific statements about roles and missions that you can't cover with SEALs and combat, you know, some type of ancillary Anglico type of design. So that makes me nervous. But what makes me most nervous of all is I don't agree with this peer competitor nonsense. China has a gigantic army that's filled with two-year conscripts. They have no capability to project that power anywhere. The only way we're going to tangle with them is if they lure us into Korea or someplace like that. And even then, I don't see them as the gigantic threat. And I don't see us being at war with China without mobilizing the American economy and the American people for war. I mean, I understand a strategy in which we, as a MAGTAF, with our own ability to sustain ourselves in little combat packages, hold the line while we mobilize back home. But forward deployed Marines in that, it's expensive to forward deploy Marines. Korea's pissing and moaning right now about paying their share for housing our troops there, as has Japan with Okinawa and whatnot. And I believe we're going to eat the cost for Guam. No, I know Japanese is doing a lot of money for that. But it's expensive to have people like that forward deployed all the time. I'm very nervous. I don't like it. I don't like it. Because I don't agree that anybody's going to start taking out aircraft carriers, because to me, they might as well launch a nuke. You sink an aircraft carrier, what the hell do you think is going to happen next? Come on. I don't agree with it. I don't agree with it at all.
So you don't agree with the fundamental premise of peer? You don't agree with the fundamental premise of fighting within and not into, right? And this,
I'm all for it. It sounds like the kind of stuff that I would be for. But there's limitations to American force projection power. One of them is every guy you got out there is costing you $1 million a year in overhead. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that he's talking about that, quite frankly, Eric Prince could do for 10% of the damn cost. And I don't think that Congress and him aren't going to figure all that shit out. I mean,
to me, the question is, relative to the national security strategy, is this: how nuanced can the Marine Corps be? Because what happens if that's not the war we fight? You have to be a general enough organization to go fight, you know, in every clime and place. So how nuanced, and who gets that nuance, you know, if that's the vision? So
remember now, after Vietnam, the Army put a lot of its logistics force into the reserve specifically so they couldn't get screwed over by the president and forced into Vietnam again. At least that's what my understanding was. The Marine Corps instead became the force in readiness, you know, because they've got their own logistics. They've got their own aircraft. They've got their own artillery and tanks. So they've got little packets of force to project, right? That was to me the way, because we need to contract our military spending unless we're going to start running counterinsurgencies in Mexico, because the money's, I'm just telling you, but I don't see us maintaining this gigantic presence around the world indefinitely, and damn sure not into a Democrat administration.
Yeah, both making good points. What about this idea? Maybe General Berger's not talking to us when he gives that speech. Maybe he's talking to the Navy, because basically it says the Navy no longer chooses to be, you know, no longer, you know, puts its money behind power projection. So we're going to go back to those good old days of advanced base forces and stuff. Yeah, because we just don't have the national will to challenge, you know, peer competitor, near peer competitors in their own areas. You know, the Brits control the world with way less people than anybody else just by having the Navy and the bases in Gibraltar and Suez, and that they're at the other control point. So maybe what he's saying is, hey, Navy, you know, if America wants to continue to be the influencer that we have been, you need to step up. And nuke subs and things that can just destroy stuff ain't going to get it.
I don't know. That's a different take on all of it. To me, he seems like...
That's stupid, you know what I mean? He knows everything that Tim was saying. He knows that, you know?
That's right. That's what it bothers me.
Yeah, but to me, what it sounds like he's saying is we're going to have small units, and he said the Marine Corps might have to shrink to pay for it, which is kind of interesting, because you got to get a promise in from Congress that which we save in personnel, we're going to be allowed to transfer into technology, and that's not the same money.
So imagine this: here's General Berger talking to President Trump. President Trump, hey, what's this baloney about shrinking the service? Shrink on the Marine Corps. I want the Marines, like, I want you guys, like, when Iwo Jima, you know, and Case Island and stuff. I like that shit. I like that. I like that raising the flag thing and everything, you know? And, well, you know, we just can't. We had the Navy, you know, ferrying us around to do all that stuff, and now our bus has got a flat.
I think General Kelly would have put that bug in his ear if it was going to work, brother. That's a great idea, though.
But who knows? I mean, just the other thing is, for his, and we know what President Trump thinks. He says it every day out there in front of the helicopter, you know, at his dinner, giving a dog a medal. He'll tell you all kind of shit. But we don't hear from anybody else. You know, we don't really hear. I don't know anymore. The problem is, we're to the point where we know these guys who are running things now. And when they say stuff, it's like, is this the riddle of the Sphinx or what? Does this mean something else? What, you know?
Well, and again, I mean, how much can you, again, when we shrank the DOD, the peace dividend of, you know, of the wall coming down and all that, and then we decided, okay, we're not going to have to fight two wars simultaneously, okay? And we're going to fight one. And that's just an admission of the obvious, you know, blah, 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 because we drew the force down. Okay, so that's now, can you afford a Marine Corps that's that nuanced? And I don't know that, you know. So, and what do you pay for? So if you look at the Marine Corps and you say, okay, I love the idea, fight within, you know, embedded with the naval strategy, blah, 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 right? If you believe that, okay, then what happens if we have to go to war in Africa over whatever? And it's a shooting tank war. How do you guys play? We gave that shit up.
It's a limited war strategy. It's anticipating all wars in the future will be really confined to the force at hand. And it's a loser strategy because what's going to happen in the future
loser.
Is something you don't see coming. It's loser thing. It is.
Whoa. Be very careful with the
L. No. You can't anticipate and design this thing based on the assumption that every war in the future is going to be limited. We've already got that experience. We're fighting a limited war. Our enemies have unlimited aims and objectives. They're fighting an unlimited war. And it doesn't really work out for us, no matter how well we do tactically. It has never worked out for us. And he's assuming in the future that's all we're going to see. But what happens is somehow we get into an unlimited, a big war, where we're mobilizing the economy. We're training recruits. What about that? You don't think that's going to happen? It might. Maybe not. I don't know. But it's a hell of a bet. It's a hell of a gamble.
And fate always plays practical jokes.
I know. Okay.
That dividend that Mac was talking about. What happens 6 months later? Saddam invades Kuwait. It's tank country. It's artillery regiment country. And what do? Right before that, we gave up our self-propelled arty. We all got rid of that because we had to be more light and ready to fight people in El Salvador, blah, blah, blah. And here we are now getting geared up for the biggest, I mean, really, since El Ali Main, you know.
Right.
Gunfight.
The biggest cast anybody's ever been on.
It does it again because the enemy melts away like piss on a flat rock. They just dry up, you know. But what, you know, you always conjecture, what if this had happened instead? What if they had a couple real gritty units there hanging on a piece of ground, like hanging on to Kuwait City, made it a little bit more bloody? You wonder, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Mike Marletto said, you know, when we did all the simulations, right, with the Iraqis, I mean, our casualties were huge.
Right.
Because we had competent guys running their weapon system. Right. And that's who played the role of the op for.
Right.
You know, that's what you owe, the intellectual rigor. But what the truth is they're not competent with those weapon systems. They're not trained enough. They don't know how to adjust to the friction of it. And they fucking run. And so it's pretty interesting to hear his take on all that. You know, was it you or somebody else told me about the show about World War II on Netflix?
I might have mentioned it. You talking about the new World War II in color?
Yeah. The greatest events of World War II or something like that?
Yeah.
What's the name of that thing?
I've watched it, but I don't recall telling you about it, brother. I don't think I've brought that up before. I have seen it.
I was watching it. I'll tell you what, it's really well done. It's really well done. And I was watching Pearl Harbor and Midway last night. And Midway, man, what an unbelievable, right?
Yeah. 5 minutes.
Say that again?
5 minutes at Midway changed the whole war, the whole world, really.
Right.
I mean, getting shot to shit, but that bringing all the Japanese fighters down at wave top level, and then by accident, the dive bombers following that destroyer to the main body at the exact right time, perfectly coordinated, total accident.
Yep. And then another flight of dive bombers shows up from a different axis at the same fucking time.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, and it's like, but you're watching it, and you're just like, holy shit. Same thing with Pearl Harbor. I mean, they drill into enough detail of it and into the terms of why. You know, why was this like this? You know, these cables, you know, Kimmel and Short, the intel they got was that there was going to be an attack, but it wasn't going to be Pearl Harbor, right?
Right.
And so they had, you know, everything inside the harbor, right? Low, they loved Pearl Harbor because it was a relatively shallow, 45 feet to 50 feet, you know, shallow draft. Most torpedoes had to go to 60. The Japanese solved that. And so and then why were all the aircraft lined up? Well, you know, they didn't want insurgents, you know, or somebody, you know, to do anything if they spread them out too far. So they were all consolidated. So it walks you through. I thought it was really good, both the Pearl Harbor one that I watched and the Midway one, though, is fascinating.
The movie Midway or the...
No, this thing on Netflix.
The movie Midway, I saw that Saturday. Midway?
What's that? It's really... it's the one that's just out, right?
Yeah, it's not... It's a minimum of bullshit. It really goes into these guys, you know, and the torpedo guys, the dive bomb guys. Admiral Nimitz is the guy from
Dennis
Cheers.
Quaid.
You know,
Dennis Quaid is Admiral
Nimitz? Oh no, that was Halsey. No, Nimitz is Woody Harrelson.
Yeah, Woody Harrelson is Nimitz.
Oh my God!
Quaid is Halsey, but they do good, man. I gotta tell you, they do good.
On Netflix, it's the greatest events of World War II in color.
And, I gotta get that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's,
yeah, it's good.
Number one is the Blitzkrieg, and they're all 50 minutes. Two is the Battle of Berlin. Three is Pearl Harbor. Four is Midway. Five is Stalingrad. Six is D-Day. Seven is Battle of the Bulge. Eight is the Dresden Firestorm. Nine is Liberation of Buchenwald. And 10 is Hiroshima. So, what do you think, Timmy? But I mean, to me, they're all pretty well done. I enjoyed the different historians that were on. I think it's a balanced look. And as somebody might have told me last week that, about it because they said, hey, it said that the Germans gave their guys methamphetamines, during the initial offensive into France. And like, he said, I'd never heard that before.
You know, the weakness of those cell formats are normally in the historians that come on. Some of them are dreadful, but right. But you're right. That series has some interesting, you know, current, I like it. But you know what? Going back to Midway, you know, it accurately depicts that our torpedoes hit the few that got through, hit the carriers and just broke apart and fell in. You know, they were completely ineffective.
Right.
And I was thinking about that when I listened to Colonel Marletto. What surprised them? And I don't think in the history of American armed forces have we gone into a conflict where what was surprising was our munitions were more effective than we ever imagined,
right.
And the enemy was less capable than we could ever imagine. That was an interesting perspective. I think it's probably the first time ever.
Yeah, that movie, that Midway movie really shows those torpedoes not hitting. And, you know, I read this book, War and Remembrance, my favorite.
Right.
Book about World War II, and they talk about that, and the submarine, one of the main characters, a submariner in that book, and then the miniseries. But you get the frustration of going through all this peril, you get close enough, you put a fish with these guys, and then the thing just gonk, you know, it just doesn't go off. You can see it's like make you cry, you know?
Oh my God. Well, you know, in fact, in this thing, it talks about that, you know, that the dud rate on those torpedoes was 90%.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, prior to the Battle of Midway. I mean, so it's like Pearl Harbor happens. And so now we're going to, all right, boys, we got to get after this. We got to get good at, really good at this. And so they start training and it's still 90%. And those fuckers, man, they get in those torpedo, you know, planes, right? With, you know, balls the size of, you know, Montana, and knowing, right, that, you know, they've got to go, and they get annihilated, and it's that sacrifice, though, that ties up the zeros and allow the other two flights to get through, like, unscathed, and then, as I don't know, Timmy or Jeff said, you know, that 5 minutes, four Japanese carriers get annihilated.
Well, three in the 5 minutes, and then the
last one later.
Right. Admiral Nagumo, who is scornful of Americans, as he's thinking, he's probably like, you know, God damn it, these guys got better. it was this amazing thing. It's like the Japanese were, their torpedoes were ass-kicking. Like during the Battle of Guadalcanal, the naval Battle of Guadalcanal, they're losing, and they set out this shotgun blast of surface ship-mounted long-lance torpedoes that they're out 22,000 yards, and they sink, like, I don't know, four ships in this. It's kind of like a reverse of Midway, you know, almost made us have to evacuate or go to guerrilla warfare in Guadalcanal, you know, because of the lack of support.
Go to guerrilla warfare, man.
That was one of the co-hosts, man.
Oh, shit. Because, yeah, you read that story, and that's straight up crazy. Like, Marines go ashore there, right? And then the Navy gets fucking thumped, and they leave. Like, hey, hey. And then, the stories of, on a nightly basis, right, they used to call these Japanese naval task forces, come down the slot and try to blow the fucking shit out of everybody. And what that did, the way they lived, what they ate, that was a pretty grim event.
Yeah.
And that plane that they had, what was that, the Dauntless, I think, when they were back that way, that plane was a piece of crap, too. I mean, it was completely inferior to what the Japanese had.
Oh, no, but you read it, and you know, it is, no, I would recommend it. It's called Greatest Events of World War II in Color, and it's on Netflix. I like Timmy said, I've enjoyed it. A lot of times, as Tim said, the historians that come on suck. You know, and the other thing I like is they do a lot of map stuff on it. You know, for instance, they show, you know, Germany's expansion. You know, they show Japan's expansion into Manchuria and then into northern China, the rape of Nanking and all that kind of stuff. And what the Japanese, and then really what the Americans had done to Japan and why this relationship existed the way it existed, which I thought was pretty interesting as well. And then the wrong conclusions we draw from our intel. Like, for instance, all across the world, it's noted through intelligence sources that the Japanese are burning a lot of shit at their embassies in the backyards. And then the interpretation was, oh, they're doing that, at least in the United States, because they think we're going to invade them. Yeah. Oops. Did get that one right.
Colonel Coates insisted, I mean, if I was going to get me a headlock, if I did, I read the book, Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors.
Oh, yeah.
The Battle of Surigao Straits there, and how the task force, Sprague's task force, how they held off the whole Japanese Navy, you know, because there's a mistake made about where they're coming. It was during
Halsey goes for, he goes for the bait. The Japanese were great at, like, fashioning these fucking ruses, right? And then try to get the Americans to chase something, and that's what they did in this thing. And the here's how I learned about this. I interview a Marine captain. Her name is Lauren Serrano. And I can't, she wrote an article about women, I think, if I'm not mistaken, at recruit training.
Right.
So I interview her, and it's a great interview. And then afterwards, we're talking. Oh, no. It was during the interview, and I said, well, how'd you get interested in the military? She said, well, you know, I have a family that serves. My grandfather was killed in the battle of, what is that? What's the name of the battle?
It's either Surigao Straits or
Yeah, that's it. And so somebody, a guy who listens in Ohio, who used to be a Marine, sends me the book. And you read this, and what happens is, fucking Halsey takes the carriers and goes and chases a task force, and then they're driving another task force right to annihilate the landing on what, Mindanao? I can't remember what island.
It was Leyte Gulf.
Leyte Gulf. And so these destroyers say, all right, boys, let's fucking go. Let's do this shit. And they drive straight in and they take them the fuck on and a bunch of them get whacked. And her grandfather died in that thing.
Yeah.
And, but it's like when dinosaurs roam, you know, right roamed the planet.
It is Samuel Roberts.
Yes.
I thought, oh, this must be an old Navy hero they named this ship after. No, he's the guy, kid who got killed earlier in the war. Samuel Roberts, he's a coxswain supporting the Marines on Guadalcanal. And he got killed drawing fire away from the Marines. You know, he had a landing craft he was driving. And so the mom, she says, look, my other son is going through Navy boot camp. She gets in touch with the, and the ship's not even built yet. It's in Texas finishing up. She gets a hold of the captain who's down there, you know, overseeing this thing. The captain and the officers, like five officers, are watching them build this ship, this destroyer, right? And so he says, my son's in boot camp. He gets the kid, like Joe Roberts or whatever, right? And nobody on the ship knows the kid's connection because the XO is named Roberts. And he's got no relation to the, you know. But, you know, and then until they've been in combat and the kid proved himself, he says, hey, look, this kid here, his brother, this ship, his name is his brother. They had unbelievably tight cohesion, those tin cans, you know, especially ones in that fight. And my dad and my uncle were in the Second World War. My uncle Chet especially got sunk twice in tin cans, as he called them. And my dad was in a destroyer at the end of the war.
Hold on, let me read this. This is a quote from the captain, right, of the USS Samuel B. Roberts, right? Lieutenant Commander Robert W. Copeland, right, gets on the 1MC and says this will be a fight against overwhelming odds from which survival cannot be expected. We will do what damage we can. Like here you are down there eating your Rice Krispies, right? And Kenny looks at Lynch and says, what the fuck did he just say? What did he just say? And he says,
I hate when this happens.
Hey. Don't be afraid to put some more sugar on those, bro.
Yeah.
You might not have to worry about tooth decay. And they go do that shit.
That's the time Japanese saluted those guys while they're in the water trying to get to their lifeboats. Instead of machine gun in the water like they usually did, they went by and saluted them.
Yeah, man. You read those stories and I don't know. Those are like, and I remember General Allen, when he was Major Allen, I remember him, I don't know if you guys were there, but I'm sure you've heard him tell the story about his father was on, a destroyer, and during the Anzio campaign, the destroyer goes into shallow water to help repel a German tank counterattack, and the CO's up in the crow's nest, like, adjusting fire. Major Allen's dad is like on the bridge, right? And they're taking tank main gun rounds to the ship and shit like that. And then I think the CO gets killed, and Major Allen's dad or General Allen's dad winds up commanding it. And it's just like, you know, and I want to say he had a citation for his father's award, and it was just like crazy shit. Like this destroyer saw this shit and said, oh, fuck no, we're not having that. Let's go, boys. And you're like, that's when the Navy had some gigantic stones, man.
It's hard to imagine that happening in today's age, because those tin cans, particularly in those Filipino seas, the Sulu Sea competitions, they knew they were going down. It wasn't like, hey, we're just going to go ahead and take a run at these battleships, and if we survive, we're going to survive. We'll pull this one off. Oh, hell no. They were like, boys, we're the last line. We're gonna slug it out.
I'll tell you what. I'll give you another one. Listen to the interviews I did relative to the Mayaguez. I can't remember what ship it was, but they
it was the Holt.
Yeah, they the Holt. Launched the fucking captain's dinghy. Right?
M60s in it. Yeah,
with M60s, and they go into shore, and they're just letting it rip. And it's just like motivating shit, man. When you see that stuff, you're like, holy shit, it's awesome stuff. But yeah, the book is titled The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors, The Extraordinary World War II Story of U.S. Navy's Finest Hour.
Yeah.
You can get it, at Amazon. But it's just a great, It's a great read. The other thing I didn't know about Admiral Nagumo, and you know, they talked about, you know, he's a very rigid guy, and you know, he had a very short window, and he should have launched aircraft, but he decided to refuel everybody, and then you know, he created his own shitstorm, got inside of his own oodle loop, and then you know, essentially, you know, he writes the fate of Japan, and so I thought that was a pretty interesting you know, he was a rigid guy in a dynamic situation, you know, failure to adjust and applying the rules does not, you know, does not assume risk, blah, 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 blah. And so I thought that was a pretty interesting part of the whole Midway narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, in the movie, they have him personally almost execute a prisoner. Maybe, you know, like a gunner on either a torpedo or a dive bomber.
Really? They
put an anchor around the kid's neck and throw him overboard.
He did that personally?
Well, he stood there and ordered him to do it, you know.
Oh.
In the movie.
Wow. Well, I'm always, I don't know.
Like, yeah, I know. But
you know what I'm saying?
This flick was pretty dead on, you know, so it was like, like they didn't really make Admiral Yamamoto out to be the guy he was, you know.
Right.
He's very, like, oh man, we fucked this up.
But you know, it's, you know, cause, can you imagine, it's like, could you go ask the Admiral if he wants to watch us throw this guy overboard with a net, like, okay, look, I've got some other shit going on, man. I don't really have time for this.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, Timmy, he had lost four carriers at that point. He was on a destroyer, I think it was, because he had just fished out of the water.
Right. Well, I mean, what was the, and he ultimately commits, what do you call it, seppuku?
Seppuku, yeah.
Yeah. And after he presides over another fuck story, where? In the Leyte Gulf or someplace else? Where Nagumo's last stand? No, on Saipan.
Yeah. That's the great Mariana's turkey shoot.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like, yeah, I'm 0 for 2, boys. I'm out.
Yeah. Well, they were bitching in the movie about, see, I thought Pearl Harbor was a pretty good day for the Japanese. But there's like undercurrent, the Japanese army, first of all, was jealous. They jumped right on the fact that, you know, everyone knows the big thing now is carriers. What the fuck, you know, battleships, you know, no biggie. But, and of course the two carriers we had or whatever, I think we had four carriers total. They're all out during maneuvers, you know, so, yeah.
And then two of them get sunk, where? In the Leyte Gulf? What's the down?
The Coral Sea.
Coral Sea.
Oh, the Lexington went down. Yeah. And then they had, but the, What was the one that survived that they had in Midway? They only had two in Midway.
Yeah, the Yorktown, right?
Yorktown.
Yeah.
Yorktown. They need like 6 months worth of fucking refurbishment, and so you got 5 days. And they went out, man, and then they got sunk at Midway.
The Timmy, you were going to make a point.
I lost that one too, buddy. I am 0-2 today. But when we move on, I'll have something, I'm sure.
Well, you know what? The only thing you could really ask for somebody is to be consistent in the discussion. And
there you go.
You're forgetting everything, so that's good.
Yeah.
There was one other. I'll tell you, the other thing I'd never really heard discussed from the Japanese perspective was the Doolittle Raid.
Yeah.
And in this thing, they talk about the Doolittle Raid. They were rip shit about the Doolittle Raid because, like, five of the bombs fell on the in the fucking housing complex of the emperor.
Yeah, Doolittle, no slouch, man.
Right, and so they talked about they were absolutely rip shit, like, because they believed, right, that he's a god, and the Americans tried to kill a god, and it's like, if that would have happened, the whole upper tier of the Japanese military would have had to commit suicide, that they did not protect the emperor, who was godlike, and somehow or other, our god got whacked.
The movie in 1975 that I saw when I was a PSC or last where they had scents around in the theater. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Oh, yeah, that was big stuff.
And so the first scents around you see is the same thing as the Doolittle Raid. But you don't see all that shit like Doolittle gets shot down. And they really put some good, interesting...
Much of that, I thought, you know, was like kind of the mythology that surrounded the Doolittle Raid, right? But then you hear Japanese historians talking about it and the impact and how... And how the average Japanese citizen was just absolutely, like, could not believe that the fucking Americans, they did what? They bombed the emperor's house? Like, what the fuck? Which I found moderately amusing. But I'd never really seen that part of the narrative.
And so then
I don't think we anticipated that that reaction would be that strong either.
Right.
Because it was a phenomenal reaction. It's hard to describe what a slap that was to their face.
Yeah.
Yeah. they really go into interesting detail about those intel dudes who come up with that, uncover the Japanese intentions by sending out the fake messages about the water pump on Midway Island to see if the Japanese would report it. And that's what exposed the fact that they're coming after what they call Objective AF,
right?
Which is Midway, yeah.
Well, and the dude, they talk about that in the Netflix thing, right? The dude used to have like these huge in this place they worked, right? Like all the wacko counter intel guys, right? And they are. This dude used to wear slippers and a smoking jacket and had these pieces of paper all over this gigantic board. And he, in the way that the AF thing comes up, he remembers from like March.
Yes.
I mean, for like, mm-hmm. this is like, he's like Rain Man. He's like Kenny is, right? With some nuanced fucking thing that he pulls out of fucking nowhere and goes, wait, boys, AF, I think I remember seeing a message that talked about a water pump, you know, and then they say, hey, bullshit. And he said, no, AF is Midway. They're going to attack Midway, you know, in the next week. And so then the narrative is the admirals are like, whatever, goofball, right? We don't have any indication. They can attack anywhere in the Pacific. And sure as fuck, right? All of a sudden, shit starts going off in Midway. And they're like, oh, my God, right? We have their, you know, this dude knows. And then,
and they didn't know whether they had won or not until they caught that admiral transmitting off of that destroyer. Because when he transmitted off that destroyer, they're like, shit, why isn't he on the carrier? It's at the bottom of the sea. That's when they knew. That's in the movie also.
Wow.
In the movie, they have John Ford, the movie director, the one-eyed movie director who directed all these John Wayne cowboy movies. He did this documentary on Midway. And he's getting, and this is true. I mean, this guy was got killed on Midway when the Japanese tried to, you know, hit it the first time.
But, you know, Ford is an interesting guy. There is a documentary about like five filmmakers. I can't remember what the name of it is.
Yeah, I know you're talking.
You know what
about
I mean? It might be. Yeah, John Stevens is one of them. John Stevens made It's a Wonderful Life.
Frank Capra.
Yeah, Frank Capra comes back, like, they put him on, like, a B-17 or somebody, sent him home, and he winds up mostly deaf because of riding with that much noise for the period of time that he rode. But they talk about John Ford had come from the Pacific, right, had been at Midway, and then he was going to be part of the Normandy thing. And and Stevens was, and all these different guys. And
Paxton made this movie in Italy called The Battle of San Pietro. It's like the best war documentary, even to this day. You know, there's a really bloody fight between, I think, Salerno and, you know, in Cassino, where they had a series of fights, Rapido River, San Pietro,
right.
A couple, the army, especially the 36th Infantry Division from Texas, they just got hammered.
But yeah, that terrain, the mountainous terrain, and the close-in fighting with pretty formidable foe in the German infantry up there and whatnot. But anyway, the movie, Ford has a nervous breakdown, and they go ashore in Normandy, and he sees the destruction, and he starts drinking, and they send him home. They're like very quietly, like, yeah, this dude needs to go. This dude needs to go home. Stevens, who had made, I can't remember what movie he had made before. Yeah, but he made, like, happy movies. He comes back from the war, and he's like, I don't want to make those movies anymore.
Yeah.
And Capra makes, what's the movie with the double amputee from 1940, The Best Years of Our Lives? Yeah, you know, I remember watching that. I had no idea what that fucking movie was about. If you want to watch a great movie that's shocking, because
about World War II.
Oh, my God, because all these guys are fucked up, but it's like stunning in that he makes this in 1946, man.
Yeah. It's the best flick about guys who've been to combat I've ever seen.
Right.
And George Stevens made it right after the Second World War, and he used that guy. Guy plays a sailor, but he wasn't a sailor when he lost his hands. It's another service, I can't remember which. And then he's got Danny Andrews, who's in a million movies.
Right.
And Cedric March, who also was in a lot of movies in the 30s. But he plays this... yeah, he's an Army sergeant. The Danny Andrews plays the bombardier in a B-17, and And then the kid, I can't remember, he played a sailor who lost his hands when his ship went down.
And there's some really scenes that you would never, ever expect to see. You know, the sailor comes home and he's got these fake arms, right? And
right.
He kind of puts them on like you'd put a shirt on, right? He puts them on. And he's got a fiance, right? His girl, and she's helping him. And at one point, he's trying to get ready for bed. And he looks at her and he says, look at me. Is this what you want? Look at
me.
I'm worthless. And I mean, it is gut-wrenching shit. I mean, and to think that he made it in 1946, when that's not really the way we portrayed the war.
Right.
Yeah, so if you get a chance to watch Best Years of Our Lives, watch that thing. It is, I mean, it won, how many Academy Awards? It won.
Yeah, it won a lot of them.
Yeah.
And then the other part, Danny Andrews, he's fucking, his wife wants to leave him, she's flattering. He's got the hots for one of the other guys, the Frederick March's daughter. That's not going to go good. He feels failure. He's going to leave. He's going to take his ID card and get on a plane. This how he got there. And he's walking through the graveyard of the B-17s, and he climbs up into where the bombardier is. He's sitting there, and you see he's having a flashback. And a voice cuts through it, and it's another guy. A vet who has he's like a scavenger company, and he says, yeah, he goes, yeah, you're the junk man, you get everything. The guy goes, junk? This stuff we're going to use for prefabricated houses. And then the Dana Andrews character says, hey, you don't need any help, do you? He goes, what is it? You fly way out of a job? Well, when you were flying around in the wild blue yonder, I was down in the tank. And Dana Andrews says, I'd love to hear the stories of your war stories some other time, chum. But I asked for if you got a job. And he hires, hey, Mac, you think you're going to we can use this guy? And that's pretty much how the movie ends. It's a great flick.
The guy's name is Harold Russell, right?
Yes, the sailor.
Canadian-born World War II veteran who became one of only two non-professional actors to ever win an Academy Award for acting. Russell also has the distinction of being the only performer to sell his Oscar award at auction.
Mm-hmm.
Born in Nova Scotia on December 7th, he was living in Cambridge, working at a food market. He enlisted in the United States Army, not out of patriotism, because I thought myself a failure. On June 6, 1944, while he was an Army instructor teaching demolition work for the 13th Airborne Division at Camp McCahill, in North Carolina, a defective fuse detonated TNT that he was handling. As a result, he lost both hands and was given two hooks to serve as his hands. He then went to Boston University as a full-time student. He was featured in Diary of a Sergeant, an Army film about rehabilitating war veterans. But in the movie, he plays the role of a guy named, Parrish. And, I remember, I thought it was just going to be I thought it was going to be a war movie, and I start watching, because they're all flying home at the start of the movie. And I'm like, oh, I'll watch this. And I sat there and watched that, and this is years ago, I was absolutely transfixed they were showing you a side of the war that you didn't see shown very often. It reminded me the other film thing that was, my opinion, the first time I'd ever seen behind the curtain of it was in Apocalypse Now, when they're running a medevac out of a courtyard and a Vietnamese woman runs to the helicopter and throws her straw hat in, which has a grenade or something in it, and it detonates the Huey. Now, I'm not sure if it was the guy before he got medevac, but there's videotape. He's a black soldier, and he's got a thigh wound, but he's fucking screaming, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't like you saw in combat. It wasn't like you saw in the Sands of Iwo Jima where John Wayne gets shot and he tips over and they read the letter and then they're like, come on, boys, let's go do this shit, right?
Yeah.
It isn't like that. And I remember being fucking disturbed by that. What the fuck is that? Is that how it really is? Guys screaming and yelling, don't let me die, and all. And this was another kind of glimpse behind, holy shit, man. You mean they have those kind of problems because you didn't know as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like there's a famous book and a famous movie that I absolutely fucking hate. Gone with the Wind, right? It's a total unholy polemic glorifying slaveholding, you know.
Hold on. Tell everybody what polemic means.
Polemic means like you can, it's a written text that basically is trying to drive home a point, usually a bad one. Like, for instance, Cicero's speeches in Rome against Catiline, who tried to become a dictator. They're, you know, that they call those philippics, you know, but that's what it is, polemic, unholy polemic. Kind of General Krulak's book, First to Fight, which really did us a lot of harm, too. But I'll get into that later. Anyway, this movie, the one part, though, that jumped out at you was there's a scene there. They're cutting this guy's leg off at the railroad station, and he's screaming, don't. He's just like you said, it really bites into you, you know? And they cut this guy's leg off. And this, that movie made 1939. The rest of the movie sucks, if you ask me, right? It's like a romance novel meets Ku Klux Klan, you know what I mean? But, you know.
But when we were growing up, it was on once a year, I seem to recall, for a while, in the 60s and 70s. Wow. Wasn't that almost an annual event?
Yeah, it was fucking, it was 6 hours long or some shit like that.
It was long, man.
Yeah, as long as fuck. Yeah.
Like, then the Yankees are all bad. Like, there's Yankee scavengers going, they're out to rape Janet Leigh, and she shoots a guy right in the face with a fucking, one of those Dragoon horse pistols.
Right, and then her mammy helps her clean up the blood.
Yeah.
Here's Scott.
Yeah, like, you know, but that part about there, the leg getting cut off, I'll never forget that, man. The guy was just, no, please, don't cut it, you know?
You know another movie, and I don't know who made, what's that movie? She Wore a Yellow Ribbon.
Oh, yeah. That might have been
John Wayne.
John Wayne and William Holden, and they go fight in the woods, right? And he calls him. John Wayne's wife was died having one of their kids, right? And so he hates doctors, and Holden's this punk ass doctor. But the scenes that they show of amputations is another one that I remember. That it's not really like that, is it? Like, it doesn't seem like that in the books I read. And so you got these little small doses of before you read With the Old Breed, when Sledge like unloads on your ass, like, oh really? Here you go, boys and girls. You wanna dispel the fairy tale? Here you have it. And then Manchester and Goodbye Darkness. Timmy, do you have anything else you want to tell everybody that you forgot or what?
No, man, I'm just thankful that I have the Thanksgiving, have a heritage turkey tomorrow, man. I paid big bucks to get a heritage turkey shipped across the country to us.
What's a heritage turkey?
What's
a heritage turkey?
Yeah, it's a cross between the original American turkey and the turkeys the British colonists bought over. There's only four breeds that are still in existence, and they're located on various farms around which I don't know that to be exactly true, but that's what what it reads on the website and whatnot. So that's how you get to pay $200 for a stinking turkey, is it's a heritage turkey that's not been frozen. So we have one, and we'll see how that goes tomorrow. I'm looking forward to it.
Wait a minute. My headset's fucked up. It sounded like you said $200.
It actually was more than that.
Hey, let me tell you, we're going to have three fucking turkeys tomorrow. There's nine of us at dinner.
three turkeys for 10 people?
For 9 people. One of them is going to be deep fried, one of them is roasted, and Lori's doing something else with the other one.
No shit, that's...
Oh, I like those deep fried ones. Holy smokes.
That's always... I'll tell you what, the deep fry is a dicey event, though, right?
It is. It's hazardous. Mm-hmm. I remember I had Vito and Terry and Dave Furness and Linda, and we did a deep fry. I almost lost my hand because I was under the influence a little bit. I was fucking around this thing. And the tongs were broke, so we made tongs out of coat hangers.
See, there you go.
Don't do that.
This is like you. Look, first of all, the deep fry event, you know, if you don't get all the moisture out of the turkey, right, if somehow or other you misjudge it and put too much oil in there, I mean, there is like you know, a litany of stories of homes burning down caused by deep frying turkey. And then there's if you leave it in there for like an extra 90 seconds, that thing comes out like crispy fried. So anyway.
Don't forget Thanksgiving when I was a young kid. My dad and my uncle Chet were having a fist fight because they're over who is a better fighter.
So there you go.
Henry Armstrong or Willie Pep or Barney Ross. Now, Barney Ross, interesting, I'm just going to put this out there. You look him up, interesting guy, was a Marine in the Second World War and got the Silver Star in Guadalcanal, and then became a morphine. He had real painful wounds. He became a heroin addict, and then he got out of that, you know, and he ended up okay, but never, of course, fought after that. But, yeah, interesting story. Mac, you might want to research that guy, Barney Ross.
I just looked him up, Barney Ross.
Got beat by Henry Armstrong. Willie Pep was a fighter from Connecticut.
Willie Pep. You know, when we grew up, right, our dads used to watch this shit like Friday Night Fights all the time, right? And you heard about it. You heard about these guys, Willie Pep and, you know, and they you know, Rocky Marciano, and they would watch the fights on Friday night.
Just off a Ballantine beer, the champagne of bottles.
When I was a kid, when my dad was stationed at the academy as a company officer, so that would have been second grade maybe or so, they had the Navy Junior Boxing Club. So all the instructors' kids, and we're like six or seven, they would get us together and do some training with the midshipmen. Then they'd have a smoker, and that place would be full. Little kids out there just wailing away at each other. I don't think they do that anymore. That was entertaining.
Yeah, that's you know, the
they probably have contests. You could draw the better picture of Susan B. Anthony or something now.
The sweet science of boxing, not so much. You know, MMA is like dominates that, you know, that whole realm.
But
no,
I still get Ring Magazine.
No, you don't. It's out of, it's been out of business for 15 years.
It's not out of business. I get it in the mail every week.
I don't know who's sending you what, but you might want to investigate that.
No, it's in. It's there. I'll tell you, this last one was about Ruiz against, I can't remember the other guy's name, got knocked out. But heavyweights, yeah.
We got raised on boxing, right? I mean, the whole, you know, when we were kids, it was like...
The Frazier-Ali first fight.
Oh, my God.
Holy shit.
That whole, I mean...
The build-up to it.
All of that. All their fights, really. And then Ali and Norton and Yankee Stadium, right? They'd fight outside. And, you know, and the whole, you know... And then they went pay-per-view, which sucked. And you had to go to a theater. But I mean, heavyweight boxing, man, that was... I remember the first time I ever saw Mike Tyson. I'd never seen him fight. And I heard, you know, in fact, my dad told me, this guy is going to literally remove somebody's head from their shoulders right live on TV. He hits harder than anybody I've ever seen in my life. And I remember the first time, I think I saw him fight Michael Spinks, and I think he did almost knock Michael Spinks' head off. I mean, he hit him.
Beat him in 90 seconds.
Never the same again.
Oh, my God. He hit him so hard. You were, like, cringing as you watched it. Because, you know, normally when somebody throws a good punch in a fight, you're like, ah! And in this case, it was like, oh, my God, stop. I mean, this guy's going to kill him.
I remember as a corpsman paying money to go to those damn pay-per-view boxing matches on several occasions only to have them end in the second round or something like that.
Yeah,
I think there's a string of those.
That did not make people happy. On TV, you didn't give a shit, but if you went, I mean, come on.
Well, those Ali Frazier fights, all three of them were classics.
Oh my God! And then combine that with what went on around it, because everybody's dad hated Muhammad Ali.
Yep.
Right. I mean, he's a draft dodger, and you know, goddamn, even Elvis Presley served. Right.
You know, he was a Cat Four too. It wasn't until I started drafting Cat Fours when we were desperate that he became so smart. A fucking Cat Four is a retard, or there's a dummy. You know what I mean? It's like, you know.
All right, boys, first of all, happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for doing this. And hold on, let me make sure that I don't have any. Midway. I don't know if you're live right now, but the fact that we won at Midway is no small miracle. So many fuck-ups, things done wrong, and bad luck on our side. It is truly an amazing story. Torpedo Squadron 8 flying into certain death, never getting to the ships, but their sacrifice drew the Zeros down from the clouds, which enabled the dive bombers to get through. The greatest generation, exclamation mark. You know that's a fact, man. That's a fact. So, anyway.
That's a good summary. Good summary.
Man, here's another one. Mac, you said that show is on Netflix? Yeah, it's like 10 parts on Netflix. Every part is 50 minutes. So I enjoy it. And Timmy's seen some of it. And we give it the All-Marine Radio two thumbs up. Jeff hasn't seen it yet, so he could.
You know, one more thing to be thankful for. The fact you have us on this podcast, it makes my whole week. It's like I never got out of my career.
You know what? Let me just tell you two fuckers something, okay? That's an empty life, okay? So this maybe a New Year's resolution in there someplace, boys, but find something to fucking do. No, you know what? It's what we've always, I think, been most passionate about, which is intellectual discourse, you know, arguing, learning something from each other, and it's what has held us, bonded us, since we all met in 1990, and now, you know, we get to do this, you know, once a week, and still, it's just, but it's this continuation of the mucus we used to call, I used to call it mucus.
Christie Society.
Yeah. So they name it that, and then we started calling it mucus. And they're like, what the fuck are you talking about, mucus? Marine Corps University Society, and so I ran the I ran the chapter out of the basic school, right?
Because
it was my that society was my idea because I saw it in the book The Enlightened Soldier. So that's and that's where I saw the instructor education program. So I go to Alan, right, and it's Jeff's fond of saying, "You want a new idea? Read an old book." I'm like king of plagiarism. So I go to Alan. I said, "Hey, why don't we start an instructor education program? Mac, that's a good idea. Why don't you write it up and we'll work on it?" So I did. And then I said, we should start a society that anybody could start a chapter around the Marine Corps and we can come together and do this shit. So we do, out of the basic school. And it's all our asshole buddies, right? General Kennedy, General Furness, right? Dutch Shriver, Brian Fitzgibbon, Scott Sobka.
That's the name of that colonel from Germany that was a Marine colonel.
Shriver?
Colonel Shriver, yeah.
Dutch was an awesome guy.
Dutch was no relation to him, right. But Dutch is a great guy.
Great guy.
Just that colonel when Dutch was a captain. Yeah.
When we get lieutenant colonel, so we would debate maneuver warfare, guys would write papers, and we'd hand them out, then we'd come together, and they'd stand up and talk about it, and then we'd rip their shit up, and all the while drink a beer downstairs at IOC. It was a great time. But, we did that shit as captains, but we'd get asshole majors and lieutenant colonels that would show up, and then I finally said, okay, those guys aren't invited anymore. Right? And I remember this guy. Yeah, this guy called me from Mainside. "Hey, Mac, I heard you guys have a really cool thing going on." I'm like, "Yeah, so it can't come." "What?" "Yeah, you're not invited." "What do you mean?" "It's only for company grade officers." "Well, why is that?" "Well, because the field grade officers, they go up, they show up, they suck out all the air out of the room. They tell us that maneuvers warfare is bullshit, the Marine Corps is not changing, and, you know, and they stifle the whole fucking vibe, so you can't come."
And your mother's ugly.
Exactly. Boom, bitch. Yeah, you got a problem with that? Call John Allen.
What? Yeah, right.
Mac, well, don't drag me into this shit.
Yeah. Right. But I remember, it brings me back doing these things. I remember Timmy calling from the bullpen, calling from his phone, calling Herb Cottrell's phone, and pretending to order
the
pizza.
R7 phone. I got a range 7 with you.
And Herb is such a nice guy. He actually, "Well, if you want, sir, I'll look up and see if I can find a number for a genuine pizza place." "No, I've heard the pizza here. I want a pizza." Remember that, Timmy?
The reason I did that is because Cottrell ran me through the Force Recon Indoc. You know, it was a day long of friggin' torture, me and John Love. And I never, and then I come in, I go in my trolley, as I go to first week, he goes, "Yeah, we don't have any positions open, but thanks for coming to the Indoc." And I held it against him. Probably a very small of me, because Cottrell's a great guy. But yeah, I had him going for 5 minutes ordering a pizza.
That's right.
He was a vegetarian then.
Exactly. Yeah. He was a herbivore. Yeah. Right? So he called him Herb. And people would walk in like, where's Captain Cottrell? Herb? Yeah. Like, his name's not Herb. Yeah, I know, but he's a vegetarian, so he's a herbivore. So, right? I mean, just funny-ass, fucked-up nicknames.
But
he'd had the land nav package, right? He'd been a Force Recon XO, which is a big deal. Had the land nav package, which was a big deal, but not something with which you could call your own. You're just teaching you don't change the package.
No credibility with the land nav package.
And then he comes over to IOC thinking that that counts for something. And I remember who it was that set him straight, as a matter of fact. I think I'm talking to him. And you're like,
what did I know? Come on, you blame shit on me all the time. I was just helping the guy. But
laughed my ass off at it because it was a hell of an introduction.
I remember.
Hell honor citation in the beginning of every class and so forth.
Right. Yeah. I mean, my awakening, and I thought I was a reader, although, you know, I hear Jeff talk, and I wasn't in his class, you know, before I went to IOC. But, I mean, I walked in there the first day, and, like, they were talking about the Algerian insurrection. And this is no shit, man. I didn't know really where Algeria was. And I sure as fuck didn't know they had an insurrection. And I remember thinking... I'm in totally over my head, and I went to the library on my way home, right, and got a book about the Algerian insurrection, so I wouldn't be like totally stupid if it came up the next day.
Yeah,
and I
also did.
I'm sorry, Jeff, for talking over. You know, when you were talking to Andy, that when he was talking about the experience and some of the stories from back in the 80s and whatnot. That would be, there'd be some interesting stories to talk about back then, and I was thinking about that, and I just wanted to throw this out there. I think that we could do a tactical decision-making game between the three of us, or even bring an E-Torp that's a leadership-based thing, because I can throw up some leadership positions, positions I was in, that are funnier than shit, you know? Some of them aren't that funny. But I think that'd be entertaining because you could go back to that time because we all came out to the fleet. It was very hit or miss. You know, things were running a hell of a lot better at CACS when I was a captain than I remember it as a lieutenant. I mean, it was a night and day improvement over those course of years.
Yeah.
I think it had a lot to do with the command selection board. And I think that Andy was on to something when he mentioned that.
Andy who?
Milburn. I'm sorry. The guy you had on, Recon guy.
Milburn.
Milburn, yeah, I'm sorry. I've not met him. Milburn, I got to put up. Yeah.
No.
I thought that was an interesting idea.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
Now, I have to tell you, I was talking to a guy who was, he was a corporal when I was the XO of Lima 3-8. When I was in 3-8, just, you know, he was a corporal and then he made sergeant. And then he later was my kid's company gunny in 1-6 when they went to Afghanistan and then Iraq. But he was telling me, sir, you remember the story of Admiral Bowser? Someday you guys got to have me when we got time. I'll tell the story of Admiral Bowser. It's kind of about Anzio, as a matter of fact. Admiral Bowser is Lance Corporal Bowser, machine gunner in Lima 3-8, but he is a legendary. Matter of fact, we should write a play called The Trial of Admiral Bowser. But this is one of the funniest fucking things I've ever seen happen. But I'll tell a story some other time, because this is a bad one. Yeah. If you ask around...
What the hell's going on? This sounds outstanding. Interesting.
Now, what are you going to do? Tease us like that and then walk away?
Yeah.
Bowser was a machine gunner, and his squad, it was my first MEW float as an officer. And we did a shitload of good training and a shitload of good libo. And we did this op, but we are on LST, and these LSTs were old and uncomfortable and breaking down. And they failed their OPI inspection. You guys remember that? OPI inspections for Navy ships?
No.
Basic Operations Engineering Inspection.
Okay.
And so we didn't get to go ashore for, like, we missed one libo port. We're at sea for 10 days straight. Now, that's nothing to somebody coming from the West Coast.
Yeah, no shit.
That guy across the Atlantic, and then you're, like, rarely at sea for more than 4 or 5 days. When we landed, finally got libo in Natuna, which is the town that Anzio Beach is. And we were on port and starboard libo. So half the company went ashore. Me, and they put us up. The town was overjoyed. It was the first time Americans had been there since 1944, since we won that battle.
Get out.
That's the first time American unit.
Wow.
Marines hadn't been there. So when we walk up the street, we're like in formation, you know, not in step or anything. We're in civilian clothes. They put us up in the gym of a Catholic girls' school. All these cots are in there and shit. And got drunker than hell. And we ended up busting up the whole fucking town. It was awful. I mean, me and Joe Rutledge started out having a head button contest. We both wore glasses then. So my glasses broke. It turned to a fist fight because we were drunk, you know. And then so we stopped fighting after a while. And then we stagger back to this thing. But meanwhile, this kid Bowser, he got drunk. And this guy Bowser looked like he looked like a young Alex Karras, like a young Mongo from Blazing Saddles. Huge guy, big arms and shit. He carried that fucking M60 like a pretzel stick. You know what I mean? Real strong kid. His wife has a baby, and she's living in California. He gets drunk in a joyous way, and he goes to the marina, and he gets on a yacht. Nobody's on it, right? But he's on there, and the Italians, they alert the shore patrol we have. We have, like, three Navy guys, an officer, two chiefs, an officer, a chief, a petty officer, and Sergeant Binge, who is one of the squad leaders in our company, redheaded guy, you know? And he goes, "Hey, sir," he says to the officer, "I know that guy. Let me handle this." "No, we're going to go in there and arrest. Get out there, Marine. Fuck you." "No." You know, so they go on the ship. Fucking Bowser throws them all off the ship.
In the water?
Oh, yeah. He drives the boat about 6 inches into the dock, and he does some damage to it. So they cancel Libo. They march us down the street the next morning, kind of like when Papillon is getting marched down the street in Paris. He's put us in prison to Devil's Island, and there's broken windows, and the Italians look at us like, "Why did you wreck our town?" It was awful, man. And General Blackman was a battalion commander. And he's like, "Cancel Liberty for the whole battalion because of us." And my company commander was pissed. And they don't let Bowser off the ship for the rest of the float, like another 2 months. Like, even for training. So, like, we'd be going ashore, and Bowser's in that cheesy little radio room they have in a, on a LST. And we'd stop by with all our gear on and go, "Now, Bowser," on our way down to the track, "Now, Bowser, if the Navy tries to pull those ships away just because of bad weather, you take over if you have." Because his nickname immediately became Admiral Bowser. So we get back to, he's going to get court-martialed. We get back and we do a switcher. We lose Colonel Blackman. We get another guy. We lose a bunch of people. We get another company commander. And there's about half of us still left in the company, including Bowser. So Bowser goes up for court-martial, it's a special court. I mean, it's in a courtroom and shit. And so me and Joe Rutledge, we volunteer to be character witnesses for him. Because he, you know, he's a great fucking machine gun squad leader.
Right.
Actually, he was a Lance Corporal. So he wasn't a squad. Zampino. Corporal Zampino was a squad leader. But so we go in there, and his lawyer was like a guy who talked like Thurston Howell the Third. He's like a Yale guy. Marine captain, right? And the other guy the prosecutor was also a Marine captain, and we went and talked to him beforehand. He had his Lance, time and grade Lance Corporal, reserve Lance Corporal citation on the wall. That was it. I'm thinking, if all this guy has is a law degree and he's proud of being a reserve Lance Corporal, he's kind of a jerk. So I have to testify, right? It's crowded as shit. It's that part of Tumas where it's like walking down that long hallway in Wizard of Oz before you get to, you know what I mean? And we go down in there, and there's a bunch of guys from not only Lima Company, but the rest of the battalion. They're there all volunteering to be character witnesses for Admiral Bowser. So the judge is a lieutenant colonel. He goes, "Gunny," he's got his glasses off, he's kind of twirling a little bit. He goes, "Gunny, who are all these people?" And Gunny goes, "Sir, these are Marines from 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines, here in support of Lance Corporal Bowser." So I start. So they go through my history, right? Former enlisted guy, blah, blah, blah. And the prosecutor goes, you never ask a question you don't know the answer to.
Right.
So, Lieutenant Kenny, did you go on Liberty in the Tuna? "Yes, sir, I did." "And did you get drunk and behave like a drunken hooligan, like Lance Corporal Bowser?" Well, yes, sir, I did. Shock. Matter of fact, that's why I got to have this squint in my eye so my glasses stay on, because the arm is broke. Because me and Lieutenant Rutledge there were, and it made the guy look like an asshole. All we wanted was for Bowser to not get a BCD, you know?
Right.
He gets busted to private, but he gets honorable discharge. I mean, his wife was there. I'm like, you know, and everything. And Bowser is allowed to get out of the Marine Corps clean, you know? And that's why we did it. That's we just good. Didn't think that punishment warranted him having that BCD around his neck for the rest of his life.
Yeah, no, the big chicken dinner, man. Know. That's for that? Come on, man.
No.
Everybody at Lejeune at that time would say, hey, you're at Admiral Bowser's trial. Like,
what the fuck?
Everybody's crowded. Not like Pendleton, you know, we're all spread out, Pendleton. But Lejeune, everybody's, you know,
yeah.
First Marine, 8th Marine, 2nd Marine, they're all jammed in. So, yeah, it was something.
We had an event like that when I was on sea duty. The fucking Midway, that scow, could not, speaking of Midway, the USS Midway, it was an old hull, right? And then they slapped an angled deck on the fucker, right? So it had this 7-degree list.
Holy shit.
Yeah. I mean, imagine that, right? To the port side, because that's where the angled deck was, right? And it wasn't keeled to be a carrier. And so
AV left leaning ship.
Exactly. So some fucking engineer says, hey, we could fix that. We're gonna weld these, you know, blisters to the starboard side, and we're gonna fucking correct the list of the flight deck. And so, you know, and I'm on the Ranger out of San Diego, and we're supposed to deploy to the IO in like, at the end of June.
Right.
So, you know, we have our underway trials and all the shit we had to do. You know, you have to, you know, our ready X, and so you're all teeped out. Also, one day it's like, all right, hey, you got to be at 8 o'clock, blah, blah, blah. What's going on? Midway cannot go to support Team Spirit in late March, early April. We've got to go. Like, wait a minute, that's a fucking 2.5-month deployment. Yeah, we know. Like, are you shitting me? And then we're going to come home for what? 4 weeks and then deploy again? Yes. Fuck. Okay. Awesome.
Man.
Yeah, so exactly. The fucking Bohica. So, you know, so I mean, what do? You load your shit and we fucking go into the Northern Pacific, right, in the spring. And the Northern Pacific in the spring is fucking crazy. I thought the Ranger was going to break apart one night. I mean, the troughs that we were going in and out of were so fucking huge. Literally, a 1,000-foot ship I thought was going to break apart. And I'm laying in my rack going, holy shit, man, this thing kept coming apart. Because there was all these crazy noises because the seas were
so big.
And so, like, during that cruise, like, a couple days later, a guy flew over from the USS Lewis B. Puller to come to see the dentist on our ship, right?
What?
Right. And so I saw Lewis B. Puller. Holy shit. Right. And I had seen it because when we were doing underway replenishment, the Puller pulled aside of us and we refueled the Puller. And then when they pulled away and I didn't know what fucking ship it was, I'm going through the hangar bay and all of a sudden, bah, 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 and so like, boom, a position of tension. I'm like, who the fuck's playing that and why? And it was the Puller, right? When they pull away, they play their fucking ship song. And so anyway, this guy comes over and we had one empty rack in my stateroom. There was two naval officers, two P3 guys that were doing their at sea shit, both the good dudes, and then me, and then there was a fourth rack in there. So they put him into our room so he could spend the night and go to the dentist. So I said, hey man, I'll trade you a hat for your USS Puller hat. And he looks at me and goes, no, that's all right. And I'm like, oh, all right. So now, do you think I can allow that aggression to stand? Fuck no, I cannot. And so I'd say, well, so when you go to the dentist, well, I got to go at 08, and then I catch a flight right after that at like 9 to go back to the Puller. So I stole his hat while he was at the fucking dentist, knowing that he didn't have any time to come looking for me, right? And that just goes to show you, when somebody offers to make you a legitimate trade, do not turn them down and force them to steal your shit. Okay? Don't do that. But anyway, we do Team Spirit, and I don't know, we're at sea for I don't know how many weeks. Like, it's what, I don't know, a week or two to get over there, you know, maybe not even that. And then we're at sea for, what, the 3 weeks or whatever. And then we pull into, they put us into Sasebo, Japan. Okay, now you have.
That's a nice place.
Yeah, it's family place, right? There's no hookers, there's no bars.
Oh,
and
no,
so, what happens is you have Marines and Sailors, about 13,000 of them, going in to, like, Mr. Steak, like, telling the mayor's wife, hey, how much for the girl, right? Right? Shit like
that.
Oh, yeah, it was so fucking. So we all get told liberty secured for the whole fucking carrier battle group back on the fucking ships. So we spent 2 days on the fucking ships, and now the wreck people at Sasebo organize this big carnival. And we're going to play sports, and we're everybody's confined to the base, and then everybody getting drunk. Now, when sailors back in the day used to say, drunk is a sailor on Libo, I mean, sailors used to get fucking drunk, right? And so we're playing the Mardet. We're in the softball tournament, so we're playing softball. And this riot breaks out at this concert, and these squids are fighting like it was hilarious. And we're standing there playing softball, watching it. And I saw one of the greatest haymakers I've ever seen. There's a squid in a cowboy hat who brings it from like down by his right. He cocks back like he's winding up like. Like Goofy does in like Disney cartoons. He's winding up and he cocks way back and his fist almost hits the grass and he hits this dude and knocks him out. I was like, it's my most vivid memory of that week in Sasebo. But same kind of shit, right? Why would they put us in Sasebo, Japan? Like, why would they put you into little town Italy? After you've been at sea, it's just numbers.
I know. It's like, Bush had just been there.
Our mule pulled in there. I'm beginning to feel like I'm missing something here. Our mule pulled in there. I remember we tuned the Japanese up on a rugby pitch because we had a rugby team. We tuned up the Brits in Hong Kong, too. And I don't recall any kind of drama like that happening. I guess we were.
You were more disciplined.
I don't recall us having tearing the place up.
Yeah. You're obviously a more disciplined military organization.
You gotta get General Smith when he was in 2-8 and they got attacked by the Lisbon police. It was a riot that lasted a whole night.
we'll wait till he retires to pursue that one.
I don't know if he's implicated. I don't think so.
So you think he was an innocent bystander?
I don't know. I leave that to him.
That's the one where talk about how careers happen and how careers don't happen, right? He and his buddies, they missed the ship. They missed movement.
Right.
Now, let me just tell you about missing movement.
Ooh.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, people have nightmares about missing movement. I mean, I know a lot of guys who, instead the night before they leave, they just go into work at like 2200 because I'm just going to lay in bed and flip and flop, worrying about if I'm going to oversleep. Blah, 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 blah. So I'll just drive myself and you can come pick up my car because I don't want to miss movement. They missed the movement and he's a major general. So as somebody once told me, it just depends who's standing there when you step on your shit.
Yep.
And there's a lot of truth to that. All right, boys. Happy Thanksgiving. 2 hours into this, probably a good idea that we stop.
Right. Happy Thanksgiving, Tim and Matt.
All right.
Yeah, same to you both. I hope you guys have a great day. Thanks. Thanks for having us on, man.
Always. Always the best. All right, guys. Thank you. There you have it. That is Tim Lynch from Texas, Jeff Kenney from Southern California. And that'll do it here on All Marine Radio here on the day before Thanksgiving. So don't touch that dial. If you're just tuning in and you're at work and it sucks, first of all, don't do a whole lot of work because nobody works the day before Thanksgiving, right? Only losers do, and only losers ask other people to work, like, hard. I mean, show up, right, share food, screw off, get paid, do not do any work. I mean, come on. And so, having said that, you'll hear the Commandant speech. Lo and behold, I was talking about, I had seen some quotes from his speech at the ground board dinner or whatever the thing that the Marine Corps Foundation put on. So it's like all the awards and shit, people being recognized for their roles in ground combat as opposed to aviation. Anyway, so the commandant gave a speech. I've seen quotes to it, and I went looking for the speech yesterday. And then lo and behold, boom, it showed up on the internet yesterday, which is great. So you'll hear the audio from that. And the link for the video will be in the post if you want to watch the whole video. So with that said, that'll do it. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody. Don't forget, a lot of times this time of year people struggle. And when they do, don't be afraid to talk to them about post-traumatic wear. Download the 3 Goals and 10 Commandments to your phone. Yeah, 10 Commandments? I thought it was 9. It's 10 now. Right? Don't fake it is now the first commandment. Stop faking that you don't struggle. Okay? And then watch what happens when you stop faking it. So anyway, you'll hear that speech. Have a great Thanksgiving. We'll see you Monday. The best of the balance of the week on a Wednesday. All Marine Radio over, and happy Thanksgiving.